wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, and it's just us, you know.
It is.
This Tuesday wire, which it hasn't been for a while, I don't think, but we've got some science to get into.
Yes, we're a bit producerless today, but we'll see how we go.
Well, yeah, we'll struggle through it. Yeah. And we've got seal blood oxygen. What are these seals up to?
Well, I think you're going to be impressed with this because I'm going to go off at a tangent here, and I'm going to say that today's Elton John's birthday.
Ah, stellar.
Yeah, and he's turning 78 today. Okay, do you know where I'm going with this?
I have no idea where you're going with this, but I'm excited.
Okay, so in 1973, he released an album called Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which is just one of the great albums of all time.
It's a classic.
There's nary a bad song on that double album. It's just a great, great album. One of the songs on that album is called Grey Seal.
Yep.
That's where I'm going with
this. Right, that
makes sense. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about seals here, grey seals, in fact, and the question is, how do they know how not to drown?
I mean, it sounds like an obvious question to me, but how do seals know?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, compared to us mere old humans, they are quite remarkable. They can dive to below 400 metres, that's the extreme depths. And they can spend up to about 32 minutes on one breath of air underwater.
Right.
Okay. Mm. Now, let's think about this. You're down at, you know, let's say 400 metres, and you've been down there for I don't know how many minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
How do you know you've got enough to get back up to sea level and everything? You know,
that's kind of
important. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is where I'm going to make another cultural reference.
Mm.
A movie called The Big Blue.
The Big Blue.
Haven't seen that movie.
No.
Oh, my goodness. You're in for a treat. You're in for a treat. French movie by Luc Besson, and except in English, all about free diving. And it is utterly spectacular. It's just one of the great movies. All this amazing underwater footage and stuff. Gorgeous music. The whole thing. But as I say, it's all about free diving and people going down to ridiculous depths. And again, the question I ask about them is, how the heck do they know that they're going to be able to get back up?
That's my
to the
thinking
top?
As
you know,
well, right?
You can only go down, you know, half the time, and the other half of the time you've got to be going up, don't you? Because, you know.
Yeah.
So how do we do it? How do humans know that they're running out of supposed oxygen? Okay. Well, we're a land mammal, so lots of other land mammals and apparently birds as well. We don't know how much oxygen we've got in our blood because oxygen's the stuff that's keeping us alive. Okay?
Yeah.
So it's kind of important that we have enough of that.
Mm.
We don't know, but what we do is we sense CO2. So we've got sensors in our body that sense carbon dioxide,
right?
Okay, which is essentially the product of what, you know, O2 goes in, yep. CO2 goes out.
Yeah.
And so we are sensitive to that because we experience symptoms like lightheadedness and sort of a hunger for air and eventually panic, you know. And that's the way that all of the land mammals and birds go. But seals are different. And apparently grey seals have got some way which they can directly sense oxygen in their blood rather than CO2, okay? So, a group of scientists in Scotland have very recently carried out some experiments with grey seals, and they caught six of them. They caught them, I know. And so they trained them up in a special pool, and it was a special pool that contained sort of a feeding centre, and a feeding station, and then a breathing chamber. Now, the feeding station above that was covered, so there was no air above that. So they could only come and surface in the special breathing chamber, okay?
Testing the distance between, I'd imagine.
Right, and so what they would do, they'd swim to the feeding station, then they'd come back and then they'd surface in the breathing chamber, blah, blah, blah. And what the scientists could do with this breathing chamber is that they could vary the composition of the atmosphere above that.
Mm.
So they could. What they did was they had normal air, they had air with twice the amount of oxygen in it as usual, they had air with half of the amount of oxygen in it as usual, and they also had normal oxygen amounts, but about 200 times the amount of carbon dioxide as usual.
Right.
And so they had this experimental setup, and then basically all that they did was look at the seals and measured the amount of time that they spent underwater in the presence of each of those different atmospheres. Okay, and so, not surprisingly, the way that it seemed to work is that the more oxygen in the air, the more time they would spend underwater.
Yeah.
And that stands to reason.
That makes sense.
Yep, that does. And conversely, the less oxygen in the air, the less time they would spend underwater. Okay, yeah. So that's all fine. But the clincher was the CO2.
Yeah.
So when they had 200 times the amount of CO2, as per usual, that didn't affect the amount of
didn't
time.
Didn't make a bit of a difference.
Right. That
right.
didn't affect
but it
the
would
amount
for
of
humans.
Time.
That,
it absolutely would for humans. Yes, most definitely. So the seals were unaffected by the presence of CO2, and all that it was the presence of O2. That was the determining factor in how long they could stay underwater, or how long they could and did stay underwater. And so this points to the fact that the seals must have a different sensing mechanism to us land mammals and birds and stuff, and they must have some way where they are actually analysing on the fly the amount of O2 that they've got in their blood. And you know, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely foreign, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds amazing. It sounds very convenient as well, I'd imagine.
And so the next question then becomes, okay, so they must have a different mechanism. What is it?
How do they know?
Yeah, that's the next question.
We don't know yet.
And as we always say on Dear Science, more research is needed.
But, yeah.
You know, this is pretty fascinating stuff.
I'm curious about that extra CO2, yeah. What would it be like for a human breathing that?
It wouldn't be. I mean, 200 times normal.
Yeah.
That's
it
a
sounds
heck
unpleasant.
A lot. That's a heck of a lot that you're ingesting. You know,
right.
And my feeling, you know, it might start. You might start hyperventilating, sort of thing, maybe.
Yeah.
That might be the case. I'm not 1,000% sure, but it certainly wouldn't be good.
No, it wouldn't be.
No, and it's going to affect the amount of oxygen that you've got in there, and So basically, your body would be telling you that you're high in CO2, so you'd probably start panicking, even though the amount of oxygen is going to be normal, but you're going to be panicking because you think it's not.
Right.
You
know, so. Yeah. That doesn't sound good at all.
No.
Right. And then next, we've got these phrases boosting citations in academic works. What the hell's going on there? Right.
Right. So, for those of you who don't know, the job of an academic, or one of the jobs of an academic, is to do research.
Mm.
And not only just to do research, but to also publish that research.
It's a crucial part, I imagine.
Yeah. And so the way that you do that is that you write up a manuscript, you send it off to a particular journal, they send it out to referees. If the referees say it's good enough, then it gets published.
Mm.
And if they don't, then you go to one journal down the line. You start off at the best possible journal,
right.
and then you go down.
Work it out after that. Yeah.
And, you know, that's what academia is all about. So ideally, if you want to get ahead in academia, you want as many possible people reading your papers and citing them. That's the really important thing.
That makes sense.
If your work is important, then it will be referenced or cited by a lot of other people. And that puts you up the order in the academic pecking order.
Yeah. I mean, being well-read doesn't mean much if it's not influencing other works, right, or being used.
Yeah, which is not to say that if you're not cited, it's bad work. It's just not of interest to a wide group of people. But it's, you know, it's still good work.
Yeah.
It's just not, you know, de rigueur or whatever you want to say. So you want to use any trick in the book to get people to read your work.
Right.
Okay. And so what people have done in the past and what they've shown in the past is that the title of your work can make a very large effect, or has a very large effect on the number of people who are going to read and cite your work. So in the past, we've had things like short titles, funny titles, and funnily enough, including punctuation like hyphens, commas, brackets, and or colons.
Ooh.
And that's a bit weird.
Right.
But so a bunch of workers in Germany now, and they have shown in a study of 235,000 economics papers and 93,000 medical and life science papers that having three-part phrases in the titles really does lead to significantly more citations. It's bizarre.
Three-part phrases.
Okay, your classic three-part phrase, vidi, vici, okay,
right.
Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
That's a three-part phrase, you know, three-word phrase.
Yeah.
To give you some other examples, so that was in the journal. So hepatitis C in pregnancy, screening, treatment, and management. So hepatitis C in pregnancy, colon, screening, treatment, and management. The
right.
three. Screening, treatment, management.
Get those threes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or another title, hospitalization, surgery, and incident dementia. Okay, three parts. Bang, bang, bang. And it seems that if you've got this three-part, or what they call tripartite phrases, so three-part phrases, then they've actually shown that if your journal contains that and it's a life science paper, then you get 32 more citations on average than papers that don't have that. That's a massive number.
That's a big number.
That is a massive number.
I was anticipating it would be sort of around 10 to 12.
Yep.
32
is huge.
I mean, I'm thinking about the tripartite phrase. I'm thinking about looking at it in an article. I guess it shows me a bit of the content, a bit more of the content than another title might.
Yeah, well they are putting it down to, and again, this is just their idea, so they're putting it down to rhythm.
Rhythm.
Okay, so bam, bam, bam.
I mean, it's one, it's a classic.
Two, three.
Yeah.
You know, we don't go 4-3-2-1, do we? We go 3-2-1.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're the Beatles, you go 1-2-3-4. But so you've got rhythms, and they reckon that if you've got this sort of simple three-part thing, then that's communicating complex ideas succinctly.
It's easy to digest.
Yes, exactly. Mm. So it's not some big convoluted blah-de-blah-de-blah title. It's short, it's snappy, and it's got a rhythm.
Yeah.
And that seems to get people thinking, I'm going to remember. Well. I'm going to read this. This looks interesting. Mm. Okay.
You probably also, as you said, easier to remember, right? If you hit those three beats.
Yep. And so they reckon that about 9% of economics papers and 4% of life science papers use this type of title or have used this type of title. So I think I'm going to go there. What the hell? I mean, if they're saying that this works, then heck, why not?
I mean, might as well put it to good use.
Yeah.
And then lastly here, we've got importing plutonium. What are we doing with plutonium? It doesn't seem like exactly the substance that we want to be handling all the time.
Ah, dear, oh dear. Okay, so there's this poor guy from Sydney. He's 24 years old. His name is Emmanuel Liddon, and he's in trouble with the authorities, as you have alluded to there.
Yes.
Because in 2023, he went and did something he's absolutely regretting now. So here's a collector, okay? So he liked collecting stamps and banknotes and coins and all that sort of stuff growing up as a kid. And he's a self-professed science nerd. Mm. And so what do self-professed science nerds collect?
Well, fun substances.
Chemical elements.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And that's a big thing. If you do a very quick search on the net, you'll find all of these sort of periodic table, life-size periodic tables that are made that have got places for each individual element.
Right.
Yeah, the actual elements in the periodic table. So this is something you put up on your wall, and you've got a sample of each element.
And a lot of those pretty easy, right, I'd imagine. Yes, iron, copper, you can just get those fine. Gold, silver,
you'd be happy.
Once you get to plutonium, you're starting to wonder, how do I get this?
Exactly. There are regions of the periodic table where those elements are going to be difficult to get. And plutonium is obviously one of those, okay? So it's highly radioactive, et cetera, et cetera. Highly controlled, one would have hoped, but he bought this stuff off the web.
Right.
Okay, so just a quick Google for let's buy plutonium. And he found it on the web.
He managed
to purchase this, and he got it sent under his name to his parents' home in 2023.
Mm.
Now, this in Australia is a big no-no. because they have
Can't imagine why.
They have a thing called the Australian Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act.
Right.
Okay.
It's and pretty self-explanatory.
Plutonium being highly radioactive contravenes said act.
Mm.
And so he was up in court the other day. And he pleaded guilty to this. He's facing 10 years in jail.
Wow.
That's the maximum sentence, 10 years in jail. He gets sentenced on April the 11th. Unwisely and against lawyer's advice, he advised his employers that he was being investigated by the authorities.
Mm.
And he was a trainee train driver, and they went and promptly sacked him, and now he's flipping burgers. So that decision to, just because he loves science, obviously, loves his chemistry, and just wanted a bit of plutonium. Not the best idea in the world.
No, I can't imagine.
Boy.
Maximum sentence seems a bit strong to me. I mean, he clearly had...
Well, I think if you're importing, you know, uranium-235 or something like that, I think 10 years would be a bare minimum, but, you know.
I mean, his motives were pure. He just wanted to finish his collection.
Yes, Well, or at least make as much of the collection
as you could.
Yeah,
he probably didn't have as much uranium as you'd want for the collection yet.
It horrifies me that you can buy plutonium on the web.
Just get that stuff,
just scary. So
anyone can get their hands on plutonium.
Yeah, so please don't, listeners. Please don't.
No,
we're not advocating this in any way.
How do they not catch it in... airport security, I'd imagine, as it's coming through and getting posted.
Apparently they did. I couldn't get the full story here, but apparently they did, and then they forwarded on to him anyway. And then caught him in possession.
That doesn't
really seem very wise.
Yeah.
Putting it through the postal system or something, knowing that it's radio.
I'm imagining now some airport workers finding like massive amounts of cocaine and being like, we'll just send it to them and then we'll catch them with it afterwards. I mean, that seems completely foolish, right?
I don't know. Anyway, so that's the science of the week anyway. So
and a moral for all our listeners, don't import plutonium.
Yes. Yes, simple.
It's very effective. Probably keep you away from that 10 years in jail.
Yes.
As well as other things. All right. Well, thank you for coming on and sharing these wonderful stories with us, Alan.
All good.
As always, thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.